And welcome to episode 10 of the Field Pass Podcast. As always, I'm Asher Miller, and today we have another fantastic guest. He is a current NBA referee, Zach Zarba. How are you?
Good, Asher. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be on. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, of course. We have a great episode coming up. We got a deep dive into your career, as well as what it's like to become a ref in the NBA. That being said, sit back, relax, and welcome down to the field. First up, how did you initially become interested in becoming a ref?
So I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, and my father was a local high school and college baseball umpire at that time when I was growing up. And then I went to SUNY New Paltz, which is a State University of New York college in upstate New York. And I played, I played on the team. It was a Division III college, and I played. And as my career was ending, if you want to call it a career, I was a basketball and am a basketball junkie. I just love the game. And I was looking for ways to kind of stay in it and kind of trying to think outside the box and how can I, do something I love when there really wasn't much outside of that I had a passion for. And so through my father's, his officiating, he knew an NBA official who was Ronnie Nunn, who kind of gave me the idea, and we met him and talked to him. And that was kind of the genesis, the beginning of where the idea came from. And then after that, I tried it at intramurals, like at the college where, the players from the team couldn't play in the intramural. So they needed a ref, and I refed, and I was terrible. But I walked away from it, kind of going, wow, that was invigorating. That was, I might have a passion for this. That was super interesting. And that was around my junior year of college. And that's kind of what got me, started doing this.
Now, you just spoke about how you got started. Mm-hmm. Now, what kind of preparation and training do you have to do to become an NBA official?
Yeah, so it's, people would probably be surprised. It's a lot. It's, it's something similar to your 10,000 hours where you literally have to start, at the CYO level with the kids and running up and down the floor in the most basic, rudimentary environment. You start with the kids. And after that, you can, in New York, where I grew up, you did something that was called IABO, which was the International Association of Approved Basketball Officials. They have them, it's all over the country. And that certifies you for high school basketball. And so you have to take a rules test, a 50-question rules test. You have to do a floor test where you're running up and down and putting your fist in the air to blow a foul or calling a traveling violation or signaling to the table. When you get certified to do that, you can then do high school basketball. But the crux of it is in the summer training and the games that you do while you are watched by other veteran officials who hold camps that teach officials. So basically in all these camps, these ABCD, these Nike camps that go on in the summer with high school players who want to get picked up and go to, colleges and get scholarships. In conjunction with that, officials are running referee camps. And so the guys or ladies refereeing those games are also trying out or also trying to learn the craft of officiating.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I mean, it really does take a lot of training to become a ref.
Yeah.
Next question in this little mini segment, I'm going to call it. Can you describe a typical day for you during an NBA season?
Yep. So I'm one of those that I need a routine. I need a routine. A routine kind of gives me a base and kind of keeps me calm and clear-minded, which is what you need when you go out on the floor as an official. You need to be calm and have clarity of thought. And so I do the same thing in October in a preseason game that I would do, in a playoff game. Mm-hmm. And it's wake up in the morning, I'm going to have a light breakfast, have coffee, probably around 7:30 in the morning. Go over any emails or anything that comes down from the league in terms of, we have a weekly rules test. We have plays that are sent to us from the previous game that we have to respond to. All those work-related things, I'll do that between 7:30 and 9. 9 a.m., every day I'm going down to the gym and I'm working out from 9 to 11, which for us involves a lot of cardio because you have to stay as you get older, you have to stay slim to keep the pressure off of your knees and your back and your feet, because you know, you're out there running around with these gazelles who are 19, 20, 21 years old sometimes, and you got to be able to keep up. So that's 9 to 11. I do that. At 11:30, we then have our crew meeting for the day, which is the three referees for the game get together and discuss, you know, the game. They will discuss some matchups. We'll discuss trends in the league. We'll discuss, we'll go over any, you know, staff emails that are being sent on points of emphasis and stuff like that, that tend to, you know, trend during a season. And so we'll do that from 11:30, probably to around 12:15, 12:30. And then the crew will have lunch. And then generally around 2 o'clock, I am settling down. Between 2 and 4 in the NBA is like nap time, where you're working nights. If you're a player, you're playing at night. And so everyone generally from 2 to 4 is off their feet. So, you know, so I'll lay down from 2 to 4, nap. And then generally we have to get to the game 90 minutes before the game. So if the game's at 7 o'clock, we need to be there at 5:30. And so we're probably leaving the hotel around 5. So I'll get up around 4:15, get ready, meet the crew downstairs in the lobby of the hotel, off to the game, you know, get to the game around 5:30, work the game. And then you're usually out of there at around 10:30, sometimes 11, depending, you know, 10:30 for a 7 o'clock game, 10:15. Because after the game, we do a whole kind of breakdown of plays that we liked, plays we didn't like, you know, that we called, and kind of get an idea of, you know, what we succeeded in and what we fell short in for the night. And then as a crew chief, I have to write a report on the game that goes to the league office with just basically any details from the game that I think they need to know ahead of time of, just in case, you know, in case they get a call or a question from a team.
Yeah. Okay. Now I have two follow-up questions for that.
Sure.
Number one, how does your schedule change during the playoffs? Like, is it a lot faster than the regular season is?
So in the playoffs, you know, you have half the teams, right? And so you're down to 16 teams, eventually, for the first, you know, when we start the first round. And so there's less referees who work the playoffs than the regular season. Right. And so they generally give out the schedule for the first round. They'll, you know, you'll get a schedule depending on your level and where you are in your career of anywhere from 4 games to 1 game. I remember when I first broke into the playoffs, you'd get 1 game and you're done. And that game is the biggest game of your life at that time. But they're given to you, you know, a week or so ahead of time, you know, once they know the matchups and stuff like that. In the regular season, you get your schedule a month ahead of time.
Right.
Like anything, it's scheduled to change based on injuries and things like that. But usually that's going to be your schedule. And then those are for the first 4 games. And then anything after games 1 through 4, a game 5 or game 6 or game 7, they'll schedule those only when necessary. So as soon as the series is 1-1, they know there's going to be a game 5, they would schedule that. If a series is 3-0, we still don't know if there's going to be a game 5, so they wouldn't schedule that until maybe the team won a game and it was 3-1.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So then they knew there would be a game 5. So it varies like that. But games 5, 6, and 7 are always scheduled later and never beforehand.
Okay, so second follow-up. You're a crew chief. So once your series that you officiate is over, are you done or do you move on to the next series?
So generally for me, I might in the first round go to 4 different series and work, you know, game 1 in 1 series in the East, then maybe go work game 2 in another series, and then 3 or game 4 in the West, let's just say. And depending on the playoffs, depending on how many, you know, game 5, 6, and 7s there are, there is a chance you could go back to one of those series, but you just never know, because there's just a lot of games, and sometimes there's 4 series that go to game 6, and sometimes there's all sweeps, and you can't predict it, so.
Okay, now let's move into some on-court stuff, I guess you could say. How do you handle the pressure and scrutiny that comes with being a ref?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting because there is obviously pressure. There is obviously scrutiny. It seems so much more now. All you can do is lean on the training, the work you put in. The more work you put in, the more comfortable you are going to be in those situations. And so also what I mean by that is the more that you're honest with yourself, the more that you can admit your mistakes and learn from them, the less likely they are to happen again. And so I'm a big believer in that. I'm a big believer in, you know, brutal honesty when I do miss a call. But I also believe in celebrating successes too. And so it kind of all adds into the, you know, to the feeling of a referee. It's kind of a thankless profession in that you don't really, nobody's giving you a, you know, standing ovation when we do great work. But when we don't measure up, or when there's something that we're on the wrong side of, or we get wrong, you know, it can be super controversial. So you also realize too, that although, you know, every night you're gonna work like heck, you know, work your butt off to ref a perfect game, you and your crew, it hasn't happened in, you know, it hasn't happened in 75 years in the NBA, or as long as the NBA has been in existence. And you also realize that it's a human game, and there's coaches that make mistakes, there's players that make mistakes every night, and so do the referees every night. You want to work toward limiting those as much as possible, obviously.
Right. And now I usually see a player during a free throw, during a timeout, they usually go up to the ref, talk about something. I can't really make out what they're saying. Can you describe what they are talking about?
Yeah, a lot of times, you know, the player just wants to be heard, and they want to get their point across on what they feel is occurring, you know, in the game. And that kind of back and forth, that kind of open communication, I think is essential for an official to be able to communicate effectively, to be able to actually turn, you know, something that could be contentious into a conversation. And so we work a lot on trying to do that, on how to bring down the volume, bring down the, you know, sometimes the anger or frustration of a player or a coach. And so you do that by having open and honest conversation. And so that's generally what's going on in those situations, is they're explaining something they feel is happening to them, maybe on the previous play, or something they feel they didn't do if you called a foul on them. And, you know, 9 times out of 10, those conversations are really just, you know, two adults, you know, giving their side of the story, sometimes agreeing to disagree and then moving on. And obviously there's times where they would break a, you know, they would cross the line or cross a standard, and then the discipline would come in with a technical foul. But those are kind of sometimes our last resort. That's the last thing we would want to do. But there's, you know, there's a standard for most everything out there on the court. And, it, you know, we have to abide by our standards, and they have to abide by theirs.
Okay. Yeah. Now I'm kind of flip-flopping around now, but a question just popped into my head. What is the most challenging part of being a referee?
I would say it's the travel. I would say it's the amount of time being away from your family. So I'm married and I have 2 boys, 9 and 11 years old. And so I would say the most challenging part is, you know, that during the season, and I'm gone maybe 24 nights out of a month. You know, my wife has to basically be at home doing everything with the kids in terms of their school, their extracurriculars, everything that they need. She's basically has to be on during that time. So that's the challenge. And for us, you know, being gone and not being able to be with your family, that's the most challenging thing in a season that goes, you know, 6 to 8 months, depending. That's the most difficult part. The games are the best part. I love the NBA. I love basketball. And so the games are always the best part. It's the travel and the time on your own in between the games that can be challenging.
So the challenge rule came into effect, I want to say 2 or 3 years ago.
The challenge 2 years ago, I believe.
Yeah. Okay. So when a coach challenges, what is the first thing you look for other than, is it a foul? Is it out of bounds? Like the obvious stuff.
So first, there's certain things that the coaches can challenge, and certain things they can't, right? So they can't challenge a violation. They can challenge a foul called against their team. They can challenge an out of bounds. Some of those things, and out of bounds, those challenges are directed straight to the replay center, and they have nothing to do with the on-floor officials. Foul does have something to do. So if you call a foul, first thing I want to do is make sure I'm communicating clearly with the coach to make sure he is challenging. Okay. And then I'm going to get together with the two other officials, our crew, and say, okay, the coach is challenging the foul on player X. And so then we walk over and we're looking, you know, for the illegal contact or not on that play. And we can also on certain, in certain instances, look to see if, you know, there was illegal contact that was tied to that play that didn't involve the player that we called it on. Right. And what we're doing, the standard that we look for when we go over there is clear and conclusive evidence. That's what we need, clear and conclusive evidence that this should be overturned in order to overturn it. And so that's kind of our standard for the coach's challenge. Is this clear and conclusive? And so it can be difficult. And it's not, I think it's a great tool for the coaches. I think it's another tool for them to, you know, help their team. And I think our staff, the officials, have come to embrace it. And we're not at all, our egos aren't that big where we can't admit when you're wrong. Yeah, you have to always be able to admit when you're wrong and overturn your own call. And so I think we're somewhere near the 50% overturn rate on our calls, which, you know, it wouldn't make sense if they were challenging, we would just go over there and go, no, we were right. That wouldn't make sense. Clear and conclusive is our standard when we go over there. But our stuff, we have mechanics. So, and we call them our plays. We run plays just like the teams do, but ours are in terms of angles. And if you're an official or a referee, an open angle is your best friend. And so we are always preaching and talking amongst our crew, the three officials, about an open angle and who has an open look at the play. And if you don't, and you have a closed angle or a closed look, you know, not to guess on it. And that's the key. But, you know, sometimes it becomes difficult because sometimes the official closest to the play has a closed look and doesn't have the proper angle. And the official 10 feet away, who you may watch the game and go, well, why did he or she call that? They're the furthest from the play, but they actually have the open angle. And when a crew of three referees are working their best, it's when each official is taking responsibility, not for their proximity to the play or how close they are, but for their open look and their open angle. It allows everyone to be disciplined and not to guess. And that's when we're at our best.
Okay. How do you handle some, like, fights, I guess, if you will, between players?
Yeah. Yeah. It's part of our business. I mean, there's a lot of passion on the court. I think that's what the fans love about the NBA is a game with intensity, energy, and passion. And then, you know, in the course of that, sometimes it can spill over and you can get, you know, conflict and confrontations. As an official, our number one job is to set that environment to protect the players. The game will always be about the players. They make the thing go. Their talent is why everybody watches and why it's such a beautiful sport. So one of our functions is to protect them, not only with the environment we create with our whistles and our fouls and what we're calling, but also when it boils over between them. And so we're always trying to get in and separate guys as quick as we can. We're always trying to be proactive. What we will not do, though, is we will not come in and grab someone from behind and hold their arms down. Mm-hmm. While they're, you know, there's certain ways you want to get in front of people and back them away, but you never want to hold someone's arms or, you know, prevent them from protecting themselves from something that's imminent, a punch or something like that. So there's techniques and things that we do where we get in between and kind of back away without grabbing a player and making them defenseless. So we get in there as much as we can, and as often as we can before something spills over.
Right. And now we spoke about like the challenge rule earlier, and I'm a Sixers fan. I love Joel Embiid, James Harden, still James Harden now, Victor Wembanyama. Those guys are really, really good at drawing a foul. Like, it seems like every time they get down the floor, they draw a foul. Mm-hmm. How has it changed from, say, when you first came to the league and there wasn't a challenge rule to now, where these guys just know how to draw a foul in a second?
So this is my 21st year. I came in 2003, and it's changed a lot. I think the players now, players have always been great, but the players we have now really have expanded the limits of creativity and the things they can do offensively. And so when they when they see a player, a defensive player, leveraged or in a legal position, they're going to leverage that. And they are going to sometimes, you know, force you to blow the whistle because someone is in an illegal guarding position or someone's got their hand reaching in. That's been a huge point of emphasis for the league, because sometimes it's a smart basketball play, and then sometimes it spills over into what we would call a non-basketball move, or something that is not basketball, where you're jumping away or throwing yourself into somebody who's not even in direct line of the basket just to get a foul. You know, we've instituted some things called non-basketball moves in the past year or two to try to eliminate that kind of stuff. But we, you know, a smart player is still going to get rewarded when they get fouled and when they know that someone is in illegal guarding position and they leverage that. And the smart players, you know, the ones you mentioned, there are many others that know how to do it. The challenge that we have as officials is to toe the line and give players everything they deserve, but nothing they don't. And that's the crux. That's the gray area. That's what, you know, is difficult about being an NBA referee, or challenging.
And I'm going to talk a little bit about players here. I just mentioned James Harden, Steph Curry. Now, for example, you know, the new rule where, like, the landing space rule on a three, I guess you can say, how hard is that to call? I guess, like, is that the right phrasing for it? Like, the hitting the elbow, like, I really don't see that on TV, but I mean, hits the elbow and clearly it's a foul.
No, it's challenging and difficult, because if you think about it, you know, we do it. We sequence plays. And so, you know, what a sequence for us in refereeing the jump shooter is something we would call up, down, rebound. And so you're going to take a player, you're going to take the shooter up. Okay. And make sure that the point of contact around his wrist and elbow and forearm, you got to make sure that a defender is not hitting that, and make sure that's clean. That's on the way up. Now on the way down, you also have to make sure that a defender is not running through their body or walking under them and sticking that leg out recklessly, which could cause them to come down on the foot and turn an ankle.
Yeah.
Right. And so that's the down part. And then once that's, you know, all clean, all in the middle of all this, you also have to make sure that a player is not trying to fool you and kick out and kick their leg out in order to get contact. So you're judging whether it's a abnormal basketball move or not, right? So you there's on these plays, there's three or four decisions you have to make before you even decide to blow the whistle or not, right? It's, you know, wrist, elbow, forearm, body. Is that clean? Does he walk under him, or is it a kick out? Okay, it's fine. It's all clean. And now we would then go and switch our look to rebounding. So okay. Up, down. That's how we sequence those plays. Very challenging.
Yeah. Okay. So I see Steph Curry, for example, sometimes he does kick out when he shoots a three. So if a defender comes and he's clearly, you know, not going to foul Curry, for example, he's out of the way, but Curry kicks out and kicks, you know, the guy's elbow or something, would that be a foul on the shooter, or would that be a defensive foul?
So in terms of the foul, in terms of an offensive foul, our standards on that play is, let's say a player does kick out or make an abnormal basketball move. If it doesn't prevent the defender from continuing to play defense, then we would probably render that as a no call. But if a player does kick out, sometimes the player will kick out his right leg to the right, and a defender who's running by to contest trips over that leg and now falls to the floor. Okay. That would meet the standard for an offensive foul. Because now that defender's put at an advantage, he's tripped onto the floor by the offensive player. That would be an offensive foul in that scenario. So it's all very tricky, all have to do with angles, and a lot has to do with teamwork between the three officials to call these plays correctly. And we don't get them all right, but we work hard at trying to get most of them.
Right. Going back to the 80s and 90s, you weren't in the league yet. Is there any team or player you wish you could have shared a court with?
Yeah, I think it would have to be Jordan. You know, he was the one. I think the year I got in, he had retired the year previous. So he retired, I believe, in 02, and I came in 03. And so that would have been one. That's an easy one for me, because I was in the minors at that time. I was in the CBA and in the you know, the G League, which was the developmental league at the time. And so, you know, you're looking to see if you can get called up. You're hoping you can get called up. And then they pass on you. They pass over you. They pass over you. And then by the time you get there, you're thankful to be there. You know, you wish you would have, you know, been able to ref Michael Jordan for a game. I think that would have been special for me.
Okay. And final question for you. Are there any games that stood out for you? Like what was your favorite game that you've called, for example?
Yeah. Man, there's been a lot. I think so. I mean, I ref the first time that LeBron went back to Cleveland. I think that was 2010. I'm not sure when he was with Miami, and that environment was wild in Cleveland. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of vitriol and a lot of, you know, the crowd was insane that night. I've seen some great ones. I saw Steph, you know, break the 3-point record. You know, and I ref that game, and I even ref LeBron's game where he passed Kareem. There's been finals games that I've refed that were amazing. I think game two in 2015, if I'm not mistaken, went to overtime in the old Oracle Arena in Oakland, which was one of the best environments ever for basketball. The Oracle Arena, that building, I think, was shaking that night. So there's been a ton. I guess the previous ones I mentioned were great. You know, the longer you're around, the games all mesh together, you know. But you know what we say it all the time in officiating, and I'm sure it's similar to playing, is that when it's all done, you remember so much the games as much as they remember the type of person you were. And were you good to be around? Were you positive? Did you pick people up? Did you help people? Did you make people better? It's the same in reffing as it is in playing. People remember the person. They don't remember the block charge call or the out of bounds you missed or that stuff. So that's kind of what we try to talk about and focus on is, you know, are you good to be around? So.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, Zach, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Asher. I love that you're doing this. I think it's great to see you, to see the passion that you bring to it. You can tell.
Thank you again. And that will do it for the 10th episode of Field Pass. Zach, seriously, thank you again.
My pleasure, Asher. Best of luck.